This is Ben Clemmer, producer of WBOI Presents. Thank you for listening to this panel discussion found on WBOI.org. Before moderator Rachel Blakeman continues, a reminder that you can listen to WBOI Presents every Wednesday night at 7 p.m. and every Saturday morning at 7 a.m. You might hear a local panel discussion just like this one. Thank you.
Just as a reminder, if you have questions, and I am working through them, you can text them to us, and the text information is there in your guide. Another one that I have here is, what do you see as the greatest threat to the effectiveness of our system of separation of powers? I will let these three panelists answer and see if any of them have the same answer I would give.
I think the greatest threat is that we are going to become overly formalistic and not find ways to make the system work. I read a really good book recently called The Fall Before the Fall, and it's about basically the Roman Republic going down the tubes. This is before it went down the tubes, and actually the Roman Republic is one of the systems that the founders looked at in creating the system, and there were checks and balances. I think there were like two tribunes or whatever, and one could veto the acts of another, and you had other people that had different levels of responsibility. And the book says there's really two things that started to send Rome on the way to the Republic failing. And the first was when sides would dig in and become overly formalistic, exercising powers that they had, but exercising them in a way that nothing could get done. So you had one of the Gracchi that's proposing, let's help the poor, and you had the other tribune basically vetoing everything that the other tribune did. Technically, you had that power, but basically it was no, 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 and nothing happened. So it was freezing the system to keep anything from happening so that the blame would shift to that, you know, so that there would be a switch in parties. You know, obviously very close to what we see in today's politics. The other thing they said is when people started telling lies and the public didn't care whether they were hearing lies or not. And those were sort of the two things that helped send Rome down the tubes. Those are the sorts of things I'm afraid we're having now. We don't respect facts. We don't respect the system. We don't try to make the system work. We play everything, I think, for partisan advantage or individual advantage in some cases. And I think that's going to be that's dangerous to the system.
I would probably, and I've said it before, I guess, is really the one party rule. However, I will tell you that within there's in the Senate 41 Republicans, 9 Democrats, and in the House 70 Republicans. But within those caucuses, there are now groups that are forming within the groups, and so it's starting to. So that gives me some hope, I guess, that. To bring a little more balance to some of these things and a lot of these issues. So to answer your question, that won't happen. Mm-hmm.
What comes to my mind, the question is, what is the biggest threat to the separation of powers, at least now? And I'm thinking on the federal level, I guess my answer would be the dysfunction of Congress. And related to that, then the executive, always grasping and reaching, I think, the president for more and more power, not just this president, but several in a row. And part of it's probably based on the fact that the president's sitting there saying, well, the Congress isn't going to do it. Somebody's got to do it. I'm going to do it. So suddenly we have an explosion in the numbers of executive orders and probably way overreaching with executive orders. So I don't know.
Maybe the dysfunction of Congress. And I think you can see that with DACA. Yeah. I mean, so the argument, there's a strong argument to be made that DACA was enacted by President Obama, not because he wanted to usurp the power, but because Congress wasn't doing anything. You sort of have an unworkable system. So,
And then you had President Trump basically. I think, you know, the right approach, which is in the sense that this should be what Congress does, and then Congress didn't do anything. Now,
right.
Part of it's because the president threatened to veto the bipartisan version that was passed him, but then Congress should have passed it, had him veto it, see if they override it. That's how the system's supposed to work. But, the legislative branch isn't doing the job it's supposed to be doing, so the executive takes more power, and I think sometimes they write sloppy, or since they can't reach agreement, they might write legislation that isn't clear on what it's going to do, and it ends up going to the courts for the courts to try to figure out what to do.
I would also like to say that I, in my previous job at the City of Fort Wayne, looked at 25 years of City Council videotapes. I know. Actually, it was really exciting. I saw Mark for many years. I watched him age over time. And what was interesting was that when when the tapes started in 1981, it was a 9-member council with 7 Democrats and 2 Republicans. And you could clearly tell that the Democrats weren't all on the same side, that there were factions within it. So once you started to get that large.
When I got elected, it was 7 Democrats, 2 Republicans. Dave Long beat Ben Eisenhardt. It had been 8-1 before I got elected. And, so I'm thinking, how am I going to get anything done? They think I'm, a usurper and that, I'm going to be a one-termer type thing. But then I found that of the 8 Democrats, there were 2 pairs that basically didn't get along at all. So if Council Person A voted for something, B was automatically going to vote against it. And if C voted for something, D was automatically going to go for it. So I automatically had 2 votes on anything. And then if I could convince Long and Schmidt, then I'd have 4. So I was, I was almost there.
Yeah, so it's interesting. I also think when I talked to the We the People students, talking about the checks and balances, and one of the deficiencies of the U.S. Constitution is the fact that there's no provision about political parties. There was a thought that there weren't going to be them, although they kind of existed at the time. I'm going to look at the We the People teachers and make sure I've got my facts right. And so the idea is there's no check and balance on a party system. So if you end up with one party in power, whether that be through appointments by the Supreme Court, whether that be in the executive branch and a legislative situation. Now, obviously, there's surprises from time to time. Judge Roberts on the Affordable Care Act would be one of them. So it's the notion of that one-party system, there's no real check on that.
I think excessive partisanship is one of the dangers to the Republic, too. It's and the framers didn't contemplate powers. Really, the parties didn't start till all of a sudden, you get Jefferson and Hamilton fighting each other, and then Jefferson and Burr are going to get the Virginia politicians and the New York politicians working together. But having the excessive partisanship is what leads to government by caucus. And one of my arguments for the past few years has been, why do we let people put their party label on the ballot? You can identify as an R or a D or a G or a green or an independent, whatever, but why do we put it on the ballot? We don't let people put their pictures on the ballot. We don't let them put their slogan on the ballot. We don't let them put their colors on the ballot. In the old days, maybe you needed that to learn about what some politician from faraway state stood for, but now you can look everybody up on the internet, the webpage, the whole bit. Have people run as individuals. A lot of states have started going to these nonpartisan primaries where everybody who wants to run for office X can run. If somebody gets over 50%, they run that. They win then. If not, you take the top 2, and it might be 2 R's, might be 2 D's, might be the, and then you get a majority type system. And I really think then when California does it that way, and it would do 2 things. One, the voters would have to look to see who they're voting for and base it hopefully on something other than just I like R's or I like D's. And then I think when they get to the legislature, when they get to Congress, they're not automatically going to be just part of that caucus. They might say, okay, yes, I'm part of the Republican caucus, but I'm also part of the free trade caucus, and we care about the future of the earth caucus and the balance of the budget, whatever type caucuses. And I look back in history, I think one of the strongest, periods for the legislature was when the Federalist Party was dying, the Whig Party was just starting out. You had Henry Clay elected to the Congress and selected as Speaker his first term because he impressed people with his abilities, not because he was the longest serving or the most politically connected of a different group. You had individuals make a difference. You debated things on the floor. In the Senate, you had Calhoun, Webster, and Clay. And, so it's something where you debated ideas. Now, I think we're becoming more and more like a parliamentary system where it's just the individual's unimportant. It's the party label that counts, and that party label is going to give you this set of things, and you better not compromise because that's not what we voted for. And then you go switching from way over here to way over there if and when you switch.
Mm-hmm. So
that's why Madison warned against the dangers of faction. So.
So I think this is an appropriate closing question for the group, and it comes from one of our audience members. What can regular citizens do to strengthen the separation of powers, particularly the dysfunctional legislative powers?
First thing they need to do is vote. I mean, the voting, Indiana, the country as a whole, it's like only, 36% of eligible, maybe not registered, but 36% of possibly eligible voters vote. Indiana has one of the worst in the country. I think part of it is the way we do our politics, is we convince people that all politicians are crooked, and, you know, we see that with the front, you know, ads now. I mean, why vote for any of these folks type thing? And so we're driving everything to the bottom. We need more people to vote. Vote, you know, you might not, it might be lesser of two evils every time, but somebody's going to get in there. We need people to vote, and we need people to run. I think one of the problems of the legislature, my sense is we've got less lawyers in the legislature than we used to. I don't see any former legislators here. It used to be the Allen County Bar always had two or three members of the legislature. And, but then the legislature only met every other year. It wasn't more the full-time, semi-full-time job like it is now. So you had lawyers there that were connected to the community, understood the laws through their clients and the cases they'd done, I think wrote better laws. I mean, it's the legislative services that write them. But you had people that would do it for a couple years and then, you know, come back and somebody else would run. We need more people to vote. We need more people to run. And we need people to speak out and criticize when they don't like the way things are going and be willing to stand up and say that.
Totally agree. I think I've said it earlier, but we need probably an independent commission to draw the maps after 2020 to bring a little more balance, but certainly participate, stay informed, encourage people to get you with the things that you've been doing with start with young people. Get young folks involved in the process. Go join your neighborhood association. Do things like that so you really kind of learn how the process works. It's just anything that we can do to increase participation.
Dr. Cherry?
I think another answer to that question is to greatly increase an emphasis on civics education before high school graduation. My sense is that probably only a couple of decades ago, and then on backward through the American education system, civics was front and center, and probably every student had to take it. And I fear or think, or it's my sense now, that it's probably not required in many high schools. I don't know, maybe I'm wrong, but I think we're woefully inadequate in educating young people on government and the separation of powers and what used to be called a civics course in school. Kind of scares me.
That's where the We the People program is such a great program.
Yeah, really. And also for those of you who have are interested, the Allen County Bar Foundation hosts Constitution 101, which is actually the We the People curriculum for adults. So we've had lawyers take it, I know. So it's not just for non-lawyers, but we would love to have it. And we're going to be having it again in the fall. We're bringing in Bob Lemming from the state, actually from the federal national program. And then also Matt Murtis teaches it from time to time as well. So with that said, thank you very much to our three panelists, and thank you to the audience.